And it came to pass that there came unto Manx Radio Studios three wise men, bearing gifts of gall, frank insights, and mirth. And on perspective this week, we've taken a reverent look back over 2025, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Welcome to the studio, political commentators, Alistair Ramsay and Chris Robertshaw. Let's start with a marks out of 10 in relation to the year just gone. Has it been a good year, a bad year, terrible?
In terms of the political performance?
Yes.
I would have thought it was a pretty low score. I wouldn't want to put an actual number on it, but I think there's been quite a lot of kind of car crashes and flops and one thing and another. I guess that the most significant point of the year, whether you agree with it or not, was the final passage of the Assisted Dying Bill, making the island the first in the British Isles to do that. That still hasn't had the royal assent. But as I say, whether you are for or against, that was a highly significant moment.
Chris, where would you rate we'll stick with Isle of Man politics to start with. Has it been a good or a bad year?
I think this year represents a culmination of the last 4 years, which I would mark down as very poor. Our politicians used to be experienced people in life who would come into politics absolutely with the immediate best interests of the Isle of Man in the forefront of their mind. It seems to have been replaced, it has been replaced by far too many politicians who come in with little experience in life and clutching in their hands various ideologies, and they've let broad ideologies overcome good pragmatic politics for the best interests of the people. So it's been very poor.
I mean, you say that about experience. I'm sure that every single member of Tynwald will say that they have life experiences. They may not be the same life experiences as the ones we've been used to in Tynwald members, but they still have experience of the world.
Well, they don't seem to have pragmatic experience. I mean, if we can just pick on the whole issue of the net zero ideology linked to the energy security strategy for the Isle of Man. The fact is, our energy security strategy collapsed in a big heap recently when MU said to the Environment and Infrastructure Policy Review Committee that actually the interconnector was far too expensive. It had gone from something like 100 million to 200 million. Now, you take away the interconnector and it's like a pack of cards. The whole concept of intermittent energy provision just disappears. And so we're sort of left with an energy strategy on one leg. We're going to build wind farms and no real idea yet where cost-effective energy is going to come from when that's not available. Now, that's not a strategy. What we have to do is we have to step back from that, think again, and stop arguing, stop shouting, seeing the shouting between those who want to take a more pragmatic way forward and those who are understandably passionate about green and environmental issues. The fact of the matter is we need to come together, recognise the fact that ultimately it's important to get to green energy, but getting there is very, very difficult. And there you see the difference between the ideological manner in which Tynwald conducts itself and the pragmatic requirements that are necessary to get there. And I think it's personified in a vote that took place in the last Tynwald, where there was a proposal to take something to a referendum on net zero, and it lost in the Keys 13-10. Now, in reality, and we could talk about what I'm going to point out now till the cows come home, but presumably cows with little methane, I want to say as well. The vote was 13-10, but in reality, if you identified those members of the Council of Ministers who were concerned about continuing in direct line to an immediate sort of date fixed as net zero, I think it would have been 13-10 the other way. So that opens a whole discussion, if you want, about how the departments and the Council of Ministers increasingly dominates over what used to be a much more democratic system. So
Alistair, we've always had council. Well, no, we haven't always. In recent times, we've had Council of Ministers, and Council of Ministers has, in my experience, always had a significant amount of power. Probably 70-80% of the power in Tynwald lies in the hands of Council of Ministers. Perhaps what we haven't had so much, I mean, maybe I'm looking back with rose-tinted spectacles, but it doesn't seem to have been so polarised, the debate, the political world that in the Isle of Man.
Yeah, I think we've got a kind of new generation of more idealistic politicians, maybe not ideological, maybe ideological. And that's been a factor. And over things like net zero, there is this idealistic view that we should achieve the kind of perfect outcome. What you don't have is people saying, well, how much is that going to cost and how the hell are we going to afford it? Again, coming back to that pragmatism. What I thought was interesting about the net zero referendum proposal, the outcome was that it would be left to the general election for the public to have their say. I'm not sure that the election will be the equivalent of a referendum because of the way our elections work. The public don't have that much choice. You tend to choose on who's the soundest person rather than the policy views. So it'll be interesting to see how the next general election plays out in that respect.
And it was also interesting in that debate that a number of members said that the whole issue in relation to net zero was too complicated for the public, which is effectively why we elect politicians, so that they can do the more detailed research that that the public don't have the time to do. So on the one hand, the referendum was too complicated for a simple yes-no question to be asked. But on the other hand, it would be fine to leave it to the election, which did seem a strange bit of logic.
Yes, I mean, yes, there is a lot of detail and a lot of technical stuff around that question, obviously, that ordinary people can't be expected to understand. But in terms of the broad principles, I think it is talking down to people to say that this is kind of too big for you people to get involved with. I think that's a very dangerous path for politicians to start walking down.
Chris, first of all, do you recognise that there are occasions where issues are best left to politicians, that effectively some issues are so difficult and nuanced and probably you can spend a year or more as a politician trying to get your head round it before you can actually understand it well enough to make a decision. Do you think that's what's happening here, or is there another motivation?
Well, however complicated a subject is, and you and I have sat in Tynwald over a number of really difficult subjects like abortion and since then, of course, assisted dying, for goodness knows, these are agonising issues. But in the end, Phil, you and I had in front of us a red button and a green button, and it was a red and a green button, yes or no. So to suggest that somehow or other these things are too complicated for the general public is disgraceful, it's arrogant, it just simply won't do. What we need, because the world's changing so quickly these days, it's now inadequate just to elect 24 members every 5 years. What we have to do is we have to have the opportunity to have advisory referendum, not too many, but advisory referenda, so that Tynwald can be and Keys can be kept in touch with the people. And the way to do it, coming back to your particular point about complexity, is that Timwald and or Keys, depending on whether it's a bill or a financial motion or whatever, they really need to agonise over it themselves before they, as it were, hone it down to something that can present itself in a more simplistic way. And the way the Swiss do it is they have simple postal distribution to all electors. On the front page it says, this referendum is about X or Y. Page one is, these are all the reasons that you should do it, or press the green button if you like, and these are all the reasons why you shouldn't. And then you get the voting ability, a voucher, as it were, on the back of that. If you look back to the last election, the world has moved on very, very significantly from then to now. And so being able to have advisory, and I emphasise that, advisory referendum periodically, I would argue, under the auspices of the concept of future IOM, which we'll be arguing about now significantly over the next year, is that the referendum concept needs to be available to people, and it will enhance our democratic process, which has been weakening particularly over the last 5 years, as the departments have got ever more powerful in their own right.
In my last glorious defeat election, I put forward something remarkably similar to what you've just said, and I lost my seat. Now, according to the logic in the net zero debate, that would mean that the public rejected the idea of referenda such as you've been describing. It's much more likely that it was something to do with a whole load of other things that I had done as to why I lost my seat. But I suppose that it demonstrates why relying on an election for specific issues is perhaps not... Well, I mean, we don't have a party political structure. I'll bring Alistair in now. So it's... You know, it's much more difficult to be able to rely on an election to decide what the political direction of the next Alderman government should be.
And that is a singular feature of Manx democracy, that lack of connection between the voting public and the national direction of national government that follows on from an election. And I do think we need to have a serious debate about how you make that connection, whether it be referenda or party politics or a mixture or whatever, or even public election of the chief minister. I know that's a controversial one as well, but I don't think we can carry on with this disconnect. And one of the interesting things that came out during the past year was some findings from Ireland Global Research, who did a proper survey of the Manx public, that something like there was 94% thought they had no or little influence over government decisions. And then the more recent social attitude survey that came out that showed declining trust in political institutions and so on, and reflected the same view. Now, I know there's a problem in most democracies, but I think we have a particular problem with big things happening on the national level, that the public say, well, we never discussed that at the election. I never voted for that. I didn't vote for net zero. I didn't vote against net zero. And actually creating a slightly more coherent national agenda somehow or other, I think, has to be the challenge. Maybe the sitting members, maybe the onus is on them, that they have particularly strong views and ideologies, if you like. Maybe they should kind of group together in some way and, you know, say we believe in these principles or something. Yeah,
The problem with that, though, is that it doesn't express itself in the election itself. I think what I would put to you today is that what you're doing in electing an individual is you're choosing a particular personality who you are most willing to trust with your vote for the next 5 years. But then subsequent to that, the concept of referendum periodically handed out would allow the the public to be much more engaged. I think Phil's point about the electorate in the South sort of rejecting the concept of a referendum, I think it's become much more clear in the last 5 years that the whole concept of the way the government is running is moving further and further away.
And don't get me wrong, I think they probably rejected me, not rejected that specific policy, well, which was one of many in my manifesto.
Yeah, well, the concept of future Isle of Man is not actually about policy. What future Isle of Man wants to do is hopefully arrive at a situation where at least 12 of the successful candidates get the concept of applying referendum in the future and stand for it once they're in. Because when new members come in, they're sort of almost overwhelmed, aren't they, Phil? I mean, they've got to learn all the processes
and of Parliament. And overwhelmed and lacking perhaps the breadth of knowledge and experience, political knowledge and experience that was formerly there. You know, the last two iterations of the House of Keys, we've had a significant clear out of older members, either through them stepping down or losing seats. And this trend means that there is less of that political nous for new political members to learn from.
It has been described as like a party of tourists without a map. You know, and that lack of experience has really shown, from my perspective, in the way that in the early years of a new house, the backbenchers are prepared to kind of go along with all sorts of questionable proposals from the executive with very little challenge. I mean, the classic example was the economic strategy, which has turned out to be an almost complete flop, that they kind of cheered on. There was only two members voted against it. And it's now going to be reviewed after 3 years. It was meant to be a long-term economic strategy.
Well, if you take that point, the lack of experience of elected politicians, and then you link it to the fact that now we have a new generation of CEOs in departments who are equally limited in their previous experience, and you've got the two elements working together, no wonder we keep sort of having car crashes with issues that are coming into public awareness.
I mean, the obvious one, isn't it, is the withdrawal of my card, which, you know, I understand the financial sort of argument that it was costing government substantial amounts of money, and if it were possible to just transfer the money directly into people's bank accounts, it would be a lot cheaper to administer. But it was so blatantly obvious as we approached a month to go before my card was completely withdrawn that this, you know, enough hadn't been done to get the MyCard users moved on to whatever the next thing was going to be. So how on earth did council ministers not see that coming and not prepare something? That's what I found most puzzling throughout the whole year. Surely to goodness they must talk about these things and must have a plan.
I think one of the features of the past year has been the extent to which the Treasury has been kind of left to get on with stuff that was obviously very hazardous, and their political radar hasn't really functioned terribly well. I mean, the classic example was the proposed health levy that the Treasury Minister went forward with as a kind of solo, almost suicide mission, because I presumably he believed in it, and there was lots of reasons why it was necessary to talk about it. But there was never any indication that the rest of the Council of Ministers supported it at all. Nobody spoke out in favour. It wasn't Council of Ministers policy, it was Treasury policy. And there was a whole succession of things, starting off with the attempt to get rid of the triple lock for the more recent pensioners, that was just went into a brick wall. That was going to be part of the budget this year. It was going to destabilise the entire budget, and they pulled it at the last minute. There was withdrawing EPA from self-employed people. They had to drop that. So there's been but that's Treasury being kind of out in front on these things, and they don't seem to have had much backing at all from the Council of Ministers.
No, I don't think it's necessarily backing. I think it's a blunt determination on the part of the Treasury to charge forward. Now, I introduced the MyCard, and there was a whole strategy behind it. It would start with providing a much more efficient way of delivering pensions at the post office. But beyond that, the intention was always to use it in a whole myriad of different ways, which would allow MyCard to be actually to actually become a revenue collecting opportunity, which in certain areas, for example, more people paying prescription charges than currently the case, and so on and so forth, that would have suppressed the need that they're now facing as to how on earth we get enough income in to deal with our health service. Now, Alex Allinson knew full well that that was what the intention was, because actually, when he did an interview in Manx Radio, when he about a year ago or more now, when he announced the end of the MyCard, he said, well, of course, I'm aware that he used more or less these words. I'm aware that Chris Robertson had ideas about how to use the MyCard effectively, and then just dismissed it, you know. That's unforgivable. So I don't take the view, Alistair, that the Treasury have been left to cope. Yes, there's inexperience in members understanding what Treasury's doing, but Treasury have been blundering into so many things, putting tax up, taking it down.
There certainly has been a lot of blundering.
And is that, I mean, is this perhaps some other thing that we're unaware of, where Treasury is being given enough rope to hang itself? I mean, is it that kind of thing? Go on then, off you go, Treasury Minister, urging him on to...
Maybe it's a combination of these things. Just to come back to the MyCard issue, one of the big questions over the recent years is what happened to those efforts to start modernising government systems that Chris was involved with. And you think, well, you know, we started doing that quite a long time ago, and then it just disappeared. All sorts of things that they're now trying to play catch-up on, people talking about digitising and so on.
The House... The new House really has to grasp this, and the concept of this group, Future IOM, has these three incredibly important principles that need to be adopted by the next House. One is the use of advisory referendum to bring democracy back to our system. The second one is to adopt unified government under the John Everidge concept, which came out, you know, 2014. And the third thing is the importance of making sure that high-level strategic thinking is of the highest quality. And we have to remove, in all of that, we have to remove the current clumsiness, which we just discussed earlier, about inexperienced ministers and inexperienced CEOs rushing off and having real power within their area of concern to get things through, and they can get it through.
This, though, is not unique to the Isle of Man, is it? It is fair to say that if we thought that politics on the Isle of Man, or in the Isle of Man, I should say, is struggling at the moment, we only have to look across the water in the easterly direction to find a political system which seems to have pretty much imploded, you know, in terms of the expected norms of where we've been for a century or more, or where the UK's been for a century or more, with a very clear divided political system, with a left of centre Labour Party and a right of centre Conservative Party, and a few others that would occasionally add a little bit of spice to political life, but that was about as far as it went. Now we seem to be having a further polarisation, to have a much more right-wing Reform Party and a much more left-wing Green Party, and they appear to be, if opinion polls are anything to go by, to be squeezing out the centrist parties.
Well, I think you capture that particular issue very clearly there. What I would do is say to you, let's be very careful about the idea of party politics working, because, as you say, Phil, it's just imploded in the UK very seriously. However, where you keep in touch with the electorate and respect them, not as we said at the beginning of the programme, as we seem to be wanting to do here in certain quarters, dismissing the general public as somehow ignorant and quite incapable of dealing with these things. In Switzerland, where they engage, they continue to engage after elections with the general public through periodic referendum, and their system is far more sophisticated than ours needs to be, then politics doesn't drift off too far ideologically or in an inexperienced way. The people should be trusted, and where you've got that continuation of trusting the people, the systems work. Where you've got party politics, it's falling apart. And in the Isle of Man, we've got these really serious problems. I think we need to retain much of what we've got, but we need to refine it.
Alistair, the world, perhaps we could describe 2025 as a year that reinforced uncertainty in global politics. Is that a fair thing to say?
I guess so. I mean, I suppose the biggest influence in the year is Trump, and that perhaps represents the rise of populism, a kind of less rational approach to politics, and that's being reflected in other countries to a lesser extent. I think it's a profound and very worrying turning point in the history of the democratic world, and the decline of the kind of post-war democratic order and so on, all those grand phrases. But I mean, they're serious and they mean something.
I think you're talking there about effect rather than cause. I think it's important to address cause, and cause is all about Western democracies spending money they haven't got to get the votes of the people. So you've got innumerable European countries collapsing into the most appalling debt. And one of the key things that we've got to do is not to let ourselves here slip into these debts. And it's sad that the administration that you and I were in, if you remember this, that we ended up with this £200 million shortfall.
Oh, I remember it well.
Whoa, we lived with it day to day. Well, you might recall that we recovered 125 million of that and made ourselves very unpopular in the process and handed on to the next administration 75 million to find, and they're still trying to find it now. And I think that's disgraceful. And the greatest protection that our government can give the people of the Isle of Man is to make sure that it starts living within its means. And we're seeing a variety of rather worrying trends.
But is this, I mean, you're talking about understanding the cause. I mean, the problem is people's expectations remain high. And as you and I know, Chris, if you want to get elected, if you say too many unpopular things, then the chances are you won't get elected. And saying to the public, actually, you know what, we've been living way beyond our means and we have to get used to a much less enjoyable environment, that's just not going to wash with the public. Alistair, is that...
Yes, it depends how you frame it. I think it's always very tempting for politicians to say, look, government is spending too much, government is too big, government is bloated, there's too many staff. And that is probably true. And that seems to be one of the key issues. I think that's one of the reasons that the health levy proposal completely flopped, was that to ask people to pay more when they're constantly seeing evidence that the money you're already paying is being wasted, it's never going to work. So I think one of the things that really needs to be clarified, and I don't know how you do it, is, how do you get government down to an efficient size? Who does that? But you need some kind of mandate, again, from the electorate for candidates who actually stand on that platform. Hmm. And otherwise, we just keep going on round in circles.
Well, hang on a second. I mean, let me challenge you there, Phil, on that one. I mean, I became so worried in in the administration you and I were in, that in the follow, I, when I stood again, I simply presented the need for reform, and I didn't expect to get in, because I thought, well, this would get rejected, and I was elected. The problem was actually the establishment itself didn't want to live or face up to the necessary reforms that will deliver efficient government. And I think where government is losing, it's seriously losing its way. It's giving too much, it has now given too much power through the council of ministers system to independent departments, and has lost focus on the importance of the real job, which is all the frontline services. And it's sort of, it's reversed into a world full of regulation and rules and making important the concept of having an increasingly bureaucratic government. These things need to be broken down. And the only way you can do that now is by adopting a unified governmental system. And that then allows you to start breaking up and exposing the fundamental core duties of departments so that they can be analysed for their efficiency.
So, Alistair, one of the things, the features perhaps of the last 4 years, let alone just the last year, has been a singular lack of interest in primary legislation from government, at least. I mean, yes, we've had some quite dramatic private members' bills, not least the assisted dying bill. But in terms of the reform of primary legislation, we don't seem to, or Isle of Man government doesn't seem that keen during the first 4 years, and yet we're told that there are something like 30 bills in the offing for this final year. What does that tell us?
I'm not sure. I mean, certainly there's been a great emphasis on plans and strategies and reports. And I think there's always the danger that once you've arrived at a strategy, that's the job done. You know, we've got a strategy for that sorted. Let's get a strategy for something else. And what you see less of is actual kind of concrete outcomes. I actually recently wrote to all members of the House of Keys just a little note saying, could you just tell me, just between us, what are the key achievements of this administration in your view, and what are the kind of key failures, expecting that they would be able to do that off the top of their head. Now, I know they've been very, very busy, so I'm not blaming for people for not getting back to me, but only a very small number eventually came back. And I thought that was an interesting exercise, that you'd think that shows that people are not thinking in terms of the collective and the overall administration. Presumably they'll work something out in time for the next year. But, you know, if again, in a party system, people would say, well, we've done this, this and this, you know. But there was people, I think people are struggling with that. So it was interesting.
Yes, I mean, it does, yeah, again, it surprises me that Even if, as is often suggested now, the Council of Ministers is quite divided. Now, I don't know whether that is the case or isn't the case, but an awful lot of people tell me it is. If that is the case, even if it is the case, surely to goodness, government must be able to come up with a few pithy messages that will make the public at least think, actually, you know, council of ministers has got a grip of this. Well, why is that not happening?
I think we're trying to talk about two separate things here. You spoke about legislation. I mean, legislation and good government aren't necessarily the same thing. I mean, let me say something sort of, you talked in your introduction about talking to the good, the bad and the ugly. I mean, maybe this is the bad and the ugly here talking, but maybe the argument shouldn't be, why aren't we producing more legislation? Maybe it should be, why aren't we starting to remove legislation and regulations and freeing things up?
That is the same, in my mind anyway, it's the same thing, because effectively what you do when you devise new pieces of primary legislation, bills that become acts, what you're looking at is a system which is relying on very archaic legislation, which is now creaking and splitting at the seams, And what you want to do is create a new piece of legislation which is fit for purpose for the modern era. So housing is a really good example. We have a very outdated housing act. Most of the housing legislation that comes out of that act, it's woefully out of date.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, there are occasions when legislation is important. I mean, I think we're way behind on capacity, as I recall. We were worried about it years ago, and I don't think that we've done it now. And if anything needed to be introduced, it was capacity legislation. But yeah, take your point, Phil. But I can't remember a situation where new legislation coming in was clearing the decks or making things more straightforward and modern and simple. It's almost as if, particularly regulations now, as opposed to,
And actually, that is one thing that government will point to when you challenge them on the lack of productivity on the primary legislation, on the bills. They say, yes, but look at all this secondary legislation that we've been bringing through, new regulation.
Well, look at this. Look at the... I was astonished. It's very recent. I was astonished to see Clause 5 of the local government bill that's currently, well, it was with LegCo last week, so presumably after Christmas it'll be back to Keys. But goodness me, I mean, there's a beast if ever I've seen it. But I would see the dangers of Clause 5 about the central government. Perhaps most of the listeners won't be into this, but Clause 5 is all about giving DOI the power to pass out services to local authorities, and presumably therein pass out the cost issue as well. So, as it were, it's almost like a poisonous challenge. This thing is capable in the future of ratepayers finding that their rates are escalating, and all because then central government was, as it were, pushing out cost to protect itself.
To be fair, though, the mover of the clause said that this was exasperation in relation to, I think it was particularly in relation to Bride deciding that they weren't prepared to follow the funding model for the Northern Civic Amenity site that all the other civic amenity sites in the island were following. And, many people will have thought, if not said out loud, people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. And, of course, the stones that Bride were throwing were effectively allowing people to say, you know what, all that money that you get from the rateable income from the quarry down on the Ayres, maybe you shouldn't have that. And indeed, this has now resulted in reform to the Rates Act, a minimal reform to the Rates Act, which, again, Treasury has been pursuing. Alistair?
Well, what that does highlight is the absence of any meaningful wider reform for the local government structure. It's been left alone as too difficult.
Well, Phil will remember that I, not surprisingly, believed in my time in office that there was a need for local government reform, and I absolutely stand by that. But I, in the end, came to the conclusion, hang on a second here, central government needs to reform first. Once you've got the fundamental assembly of how you want to run your central government efficiently, once you've done that, then there's an opportunity to say, oh, okay, how does that integrate with how we want to run our local authorities, rather than where we are now. I mean, okay, I take your point about Bride, etc., but this is Clause 5 is absolutely no way to do it. And if members...
But there is a point to this, that actually if local authorities have a statutory responsibility to do something and they're failing to do it, surely central government should have some kind of ability to say to them, you really must do this. This is a statutory function. You've got to do it. But then, as I'm saying that, I'm thinking, well, if it's a statutory function, they must do it anyway.
Exactly. Exactly, but you can't have central government, which is essentially inefficient, too expensive and bloated, dictating to local authorities as to what they should be doing, what central government needs to do, is live by example. And that thus far hasn't happened. We've since that really difficult five-year period where we had to sort of save all our money and we handed over back to that point about the 75 million, we've got absolutely nowhere. Government's been talking now for close to 10 years. Well, we've got to save money. They never do. They never do it. And now with Clause 5, I'm sorry, perhaps you think I'm cynical. It's an opportunity for government to start pushing cost away from itself to protect itself.
Well, it's not so much that I think you're cynical. Of course, I probably ought to declare an interest as a clerk to a local authority. I have to at least give the other point of view. I advertised this programme as the three wise men of Manx politics. Perhaps the three grumpy old men of Manx politics might be a better approach. But so on that basis, let's have a look, if we can, for a positive from the last 12 months. Any takers?
No. I don't think I have, actually. No, I genuinely have become more and more concerned as this administration has gone on as to where we're going, which is, as I say, I mean, I'm a retired guy, but I can't let go because I'm concerned about the future. And that's why I've devised with others this concept of Future Isle of IOM, which deals with these
principles. There's a positive. You've come up with that. So, Alistair. Yeah.
Yes. I suppose the only kind of hopeful thing is that the continuing shift in the government agenda, which was noticeable, happened about mid-term, year before last, I think, where they shifted to they were more concerned about efficiencies, they were concerned about border security. They were going to try and get a handle on immigration, and that's become a theme. And that, interestingly, followed their roadshows, where I think they found that the public weren't buying into their original agenda of kind of optimistic expansion at all. So, but that hasn't delivered any results yet. You know, we've got these efficiency programs. They've got this rather elaborate system now for assessing new recruitment, which is left to the departments to decide whether they really need that new person. So you know what the result could be in most cases. So I think the Chief Minister has actually been more responsive to the perceived public mood, but it's kind of a bit late, and I'm not sure it's actually going to deliver any concrete outcomes.
Well, I have a positive, and I'm going to suggest this to you. Legislative Council appears to have become more what you would hope Legislative Council would be, which is an independent scrutiny body that actually does occasionally say back to government or members of the House of Keys, actually, hang on a minute, we don't agree with that. Is that me just grasping at straws to find a positive?
Yes, I think so. let me be positive on two counts. I should presumably bring a present to this Christmas edition, I suppose. The first one is failings of others, that the UK has got itself in such a dreadful state that there are a number of people looking to the Isle of Man and our more reasonable tax system as being perhaps a safe place, a peaceful, safe place to perhaps consider moving to. That's one good thing. The other good thing has got to be that if you look across the democracies of Europe and the struggles and huge difficulties they're in and increasingly find themselves in, and it's likely to get worse way before it gets better, is that for all the things that we concern ourselves with, rightly so, we are small enough and neat enough to actually put things right if we put our mind to it. And I think we can.
Alistair,
is that positive enough?
Yeah, I think that's I think that's definitely challenging the grumpy old men tag.
We still have that underlying sense of community.
Yeah.
And that is a great strength in an age where, you know, people, these tribal divisions seem to be taking over everywhere.
So the obviously Isle of Man government has its problems, and to be fair, we, you know, that a number of those problems result from issues out with the control of the Isle of Man government, particularly the war in Ukraine, which caused a number of problems. COVID, which caused a number of problems. They can reasonably point to those things, I would say. Do you think they've overused those excuses, or are they reasonable things for them to be concerned about?
I think there's a tendency to try to hide behind issues outside of our control to take the focus away from those things that we should have control on. And I think the general public are now very clear. We need efficient government. We need to be able to afford the government we've got, and we want first-class frontline services. And they expect the next house to deal with it, to move away from the ideologies that have captured it, like, you know, net zero, etc., and focus on, as Alistair said, costs and making delivery work. It's very down-to-earth stuff. And if the next house do that, they won't go far wrong. But it'll be interesting to see how this next year, running up to the election, pans out.
And the war in Ukraine, I mentioned there, but there are political commentators in the UK and further afield that talk about actually a serious threat to peace in Europe. Is that overdoing the scaremongering, or is that a realistic prospect, Alistair?
I can't claim to be an expert on European politics and so on. I think it's interesting that the countries that are closer to Russia take it very seriously, understandably, and we're not that far away. So I think we shouldn't be too quick to dismiss these things.
Well, particularly when we're told that there are various Russian submarines and the like potentially in our territorial seas.
I think when one talks about Russia, I don't think the West, and listen, I'm not pro-Russian at all, absolutely not. I have, like anybody, have concerns about its behaviour.
Well, I'm pro-Arbery and Russian. So
good for you. But what is very surprising is that Europe is very much behind the concept of taking Russian funds, which have been frozen, into use. And that's a worry, because a significant proportion, as I understand it, of those billions of pounds worth of funds belong to individual Russians. And so, you know, it undermines the whole international financial system. And the increasing focus on looking to Russia as being a major threat happens to coincide with Western countries absolutely failing to deliver balanced budgets. And it's almost as if an element of the slightly more cynical side of one says, well, you know, is this distraction process is going on here to, as it were, unite people against a common enemy, so that they can't see the very, very significant failings of the current Western democratic institutions.
Well, I imagine too that it's something to do with the fact that the Trump administration in America has pretty much said, you know what, Europe, you've been living off the coattails of America for long enough, and it's time you got on with it and sorted your own defence out.
Well, yes, that's what they're saying, and there's a deep truth in that. But Pax Americana is now finished, and the Americans are looking after themselves. And
I suppose in terms of encouraging the public to agree to substantial increases in public expenditure on defence, you need to have a threat.
Yes, but that's all well and good if at the same time you're, as is the case in the UK, welfare spending is just going absolutely through the roof. You can't do all things all the time. The West is running into real problems. Goodness knows how the bond markets are going to react as the months roll out in the, you know, after Christmas. That's the worry. It's, you know, where's the money coming from?
That was political commentators Alistair Ramsay and Chris Robertshaw. So what do you think? Was 2025 a year to forget, or were there some positives in there? I'm Phil Gorn. Go to my house and geisha grum can of blina. Thanks for listening, and Nollick Gennell.